It said he putting my psychology degree to good use, he says. And it was there in late 1996 that a co-worker, Tom Cruise, yes, his real name, made a mission of cheering Johnson up. They talked about common interests, karate, rock and roll. Then they talked about Star Wars. Hey, did Johnson know the movies were coming back to theaters in so-called special editions? Johnson brightened. All we talked about that day was that opening scene where the stormtroopers come tearing through the door of the Tantive IV. We couldn't let go of that concept. Memories came flooding back. Star Wars memories. Johnson had been born in poverty in the Ozarks in 1969. In the 1970s, his parents were called to a Pentecostal ministry in the Carolinas. His Sunday school teacher told him George Lucas had signed a deal with the devil and made his actors sign papers saying they were going to worship the Force. But Johnson went to see the first film 20 times anyway. Every time he came out of the theater, he would run along its brick wall, imagining the gaps between the bricks to be the Death Star trench, and himself the pilot in the X-Wing. He would run it so fast and so close into the trench, he would occasionally skid his head painfully against the bricks. No matter. It was worth it to be Luke Skywalker. Johnson laments that he didn't grow up to look anything like Luke, and then laughs, "Hey, at least we're both amputees." But then there are the space soldiers, the stormtroopers pouring through the door in all that bright molded plastic. As he and Cruise reminisced about Star Wars' most numerous icons, they realized that so long as the detailing on the suit was right, anybody could embody them. When you're a stormtrooper, nobody knows you're an amputee. You're supposed to blend in, to be expendable, perfect for a shy, self-conscious guy. Johnson became obsessed with the costume as a passport to the Star Wars universe. He started sketching out ideas for how he could build his own, while Cruise searched the nascent web, betting that he could find an authentic stormtrooper costume. That is, one that matched the on-screen version in every detail, whether Lucasfilm licensed or not, in time for the special editions. This was the pre-Google age, but somehow he stumbled on a Usenet posting in which a guy claimed to be selling an original movie prop costume in an estate sale for $2,000. The vendor was actually trying to avoid getting sued by Lucasfilm for selling a reproduction suit without its say-so, without Lucas getting a cut. This was risky, and reproductions in those days were rare. It was like uncovering a 747 jet in caveman times, Johnson recalls. Johnson cajoled Beverly, the real breadwinner of the family, into buying the suit in exchange for the next 10 years' worth of Christmas presents. Soon, awkward plastic molding parts arrived in the mail. He nervously constructed them with Dremel and glue gun. It was horrible. The helmet hung loosely. The suit was constricting. He felt ridiculous. A plastic spaceman with a metal leg. He had no line of sight in that helmet. No wonder stormtroopers were such poor marksmen. Still, Johnson wore it to his local one-screen theater for showings of The Empire Strikes Back Special Edition. Theatergoers poked him and laughed. "I had one guy after another saying, 'You loser, don't you wish you could get laid?'" Johnson recalls. But then Cruise found his own costume online, another pricey, hard-to-construct model, and joined Johnson a few weeks later for the Return of the Jedi screening. This time, patrons looked awestruck and a little afraid as the pair confidently patrolled the lobby. "That's when the switch really flipped," Johnson says. "The more stormtroopers, the better it looks. I resolved that somehow in my lifetime, I would get as many as 10 stormtroopers together in one place. That's how big I was thinking." The pair built a website and posted pictures of their exploits at comic shops, state fairs, and preschool graduation, whatever gigs they could get. Johnson wrote captions about a couple of troopers who were always falling afoul of Darth Vader. He gave his trooper the name TK-210, a denizen of Detention Block 2551 on the Death Star. The only time a stormtrooper is named in Star Wars is on the Death Star, where a commanding officer asks TK-421 why he isn't at his post. Johnson adopted this naming convention, using his birthday for the numbers, The 501st has since used up all its possible 3- and 4-digit TK numbers. Within weeks, 4 more stormtroopers emailed him with pictures of their own. This was before Facebook, before flash mobs, before the golden age of geekdom dawned in the 21st century. The internet had barely become a gathering place for Star Wars fans, let alone stormtrooper costume owners. Yet somehow, here they were. Johnson now pictured a whole stormtrooper legion. He recalled several times back in grade school, where he tried to organize some kind of juvenile army out of his friends. After Star Wars came out, he dubbed one attempt the Order of the Space Knights. Clearly that name wouldn't work for stormtroopers. He tried to think of names that recalled his dad's World War II fighter pilot squadron. Something zippy, something cool, added some alliteration, and came up with the Fightin' 501st. He wrote a backstory that solved a question he'd formed watching the movies. How come Darth Vader always seems to have a detachment of stormtroopers at his elbow whenever he needs them? The 501st, he decided, was a shadow legion, off the books, always ready. Vader's fist. It was, friends agreed, a pretty neat idea. They helped him hand out leaflets at conventions. Are you loyal, hardworking, fully expendable? Join the Imperial 501st! In 2002, Johnson mustered roughly 150 stormtrooper costumers in Indianapolis at Celebration 2, the second official Star Wars convention, and offered their services to a skeptical Lucasfilm to let the 501st help out as crowd control when the event's security proved woefully inadequate for the 30,000 attendees. Lucasfilm was won over by the tireless, hyper-organized troopers and started to use the 501st as volunteers for all its events. Lucasfilm licensees followed suit. If you've ever been to one of the Star Wars days held at dozens of baseball stadiums across the United States, if you've seen multiple stormtroopers or Darth Vader or Boba Fett at a store, a movie theater, or a mall, you've almost certainly been staring at the forces of the 501st. Johnson's idea didn't stop at America's shores either. The 501st Legion is now recognized as one of the largest costuming organizations in the world. The Society for Creative Anachronism, an organization dedicated to celebrating the medieval and Renaissance periods through activities like reproducing historic armor and clothing, has more than 30,000 paid-up members and a 31-year head start on the 501st. It has active members in 47 countries on 5 continents, divided into 67 local garrisons and 29 outposts, those units that comprise fewer than 25 members. More than 20% of the troops are female. The 501st absorbed a once-independent UK garrison and established a garrison near Paris, though some French stormtroopers have gone their own way with the Seconde des Femmes Légion. The Germans, meanwhile, have a garrison consisting of 5 squads that are all large enough to be garrisons on their own, but are loath to undergo any kind of deunification. The 501st elects local and legion-wide commanding officers every year. To Johnson's dismay, COs are imposing ever more stringent membership requirements. Your stormtrooper belt must contain 6 pouches, not 4, meaning that even the authentic, but not technically screen-accurate, Lucasfilm-licensed suits sold online won't get you in the club. Most members make their own, hammering away at styrene sheets on vacuforming tables, sinking thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours into a single costume. Such stringency notwithstanding, the 501st Legion is starting to stretch the limits of its name. Roman legions, world history's largest, rarely had more than 5,000 members. Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon with 3,500. The 501st, at the time of this recording, numbers 6,583 screen-accurate active members. That, if you're keeping score, is 6,573 more troops than Johnson first anticipated. More importantly, Johnson and crew's creation had reached that galaxy far, far away. In 2004 came the first official Star Wars novel to feature the 501st, written by famed franchise author Timothy Zahn, who happened to have first encountered Johnson and his crew at a convention, K-2 kicking back with a cooler full of beers after a long day. Johnson held onto sobriety long enough to explain the concept of the 501st. Zahn nodded thoughtfully, went away, and promptly wrote the novel Survivor's Quest, in which a squad from the 501st co-starred with Luke Skywalker. Even greater honors were to follow. The next year, George Lucas officially included the Legion in his final Star Wars movie, Episode III, Revenge of the Sith. A detachment of clone troopers, the predecessors of stormtroopers, follow the newly minted Darth Vader into the Jedi Temple as he prepares to massacre its inhabitants. In the script, they are designated the 501st Legion. But Johnson had no inkling of this until a member of his Tokyo garrison mailed him a Star Wars action figure. Amid the Japanese script on the box was a number, 501. Hasbro has since churned out an impressive 5 million of these plastic 501st members. Ill-informed fans started to claim that Johnson was copying Lucas's name rather than the other way around. As great a compliment as that is, Johnson is uneasy about the fact that the 501st were heading into the temple to help kill Jedi children, including one played by Lucas's son, Jet. This made for an awkward encounter years later when Jet asked Johnson if he could become an honorary member of the 501st. The matter was settled in 2007 when George Lucas was made Grand Marshal of the Tournament of Roses Parade, associated with the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. Lucas asked for the 501st by name and paid to fly hundreds of its troops from around the world to march 5.5 miles with his float. Here they were, finally assembled, the space soldiers, going through actual army drills with actual drill sergeants. Lucas addressed them the night before the parade. "The big invasion is in a few days," he said deadpan. "I don't expect all of you to make it back. But that's okay, because stormtroopers are expendable." The Legion roared its approval. After a breather following the punishing march, the troopers put their buckets, as they call their helmets, back on and posed for photos with Lucas. Lucasfilm's Steve Sansweet insisted on introducing Lucas and Johnson, two shy men who prefer to run things from behind the scenes. "Good work on all of this," said Lucas. "This is all you," was all Johnson managed to sputter before the creator. "No," said Lucas. "I made Star Wars." He gestured at the rows of white-armored troopers standing stiffly at attention and carrying the flags of their garrisons. "You made this. I'm very proud of it." It was enough to make a guy's head so big it would never again fit in a bucket. But even after that unparalleled moment of validation, Johnson retains a sense of perspective. "Y'all, if we're not having fun, this is just a drag," he tells his COs. "We're plastic spacemen. If anybody in the club is getting too serious, we'll throw out that tagline. Yep, we're plastic spacemen." Every army needs someone to march behind, and the 501st is no exception. If the outfit is called Vader's Fist, then naturally every garrison needs more than screen-accurate stormtroopers. It needs to walk in anonymous lockstep behind the most famous and frightening space soldier of them all. Mark Fordham was a sniper on a SWAT team in Tennessee when he constructed a crude Darth Vader costume for his police department's 1994 Halloween party. The other officers raved about it, and that got Fordham thinking, how would people react to a screen-accurate Vader? He called the main number at Lucasfilm and somehow found himself connected to a kindly soul who told him the pieces he needed. Quilted leather jumpsuit with a blanket sewn in, wool crepe cape. "Vader is fairly comfortable," says Fordham. "He's just very hot." Fordham paid local fashion students $200 to stitch the costume together. Now he had a new plan. Visit the local schools dressed as Vader and offer a moral message. "Don't choose the quick and easy path like I did." But when he called Lucasfilm back to get their sign-off on his plan, the person he was randomly connected to this time around freaked out. "Vader is our copyright," they said. "We hire actors to portray him. You can't." "That kind of burst my bubble," said Fordham. Still, the SWAT sniper figured there was nothing wrong in wearing the costume to the premieres of Episode 1 in 1999 and Episode 2 in 2002. He got the same result as Johnson. Trooping alone is no fun. So he found some local 501st members and discovered, to his surprise, that the stormtroopers enthusiastically welcomed Vader. Johnson would later drop stormtrooper from the Legion's name to make this clearer. Fordham practiced his James Earl Jones intonation, listening to Star Wars tapes on his commute. He jury-rigged a mic and amp into his mask to approximate the mechanical sound of the helmeted arch-villain. The amp used up 2 9-volt batteries every 30 minutes, but for Fordham, there was nothing worse than being a voiceless Vader. In short order, Fordham was elected garrison commanding officer and then CO for the entire Global Legion. He introduced awards and a rank system, promoting members who trooped more. When the 501st started to do more charity work, he felt it needed a common protocol, so he drafted a new charter to amend Johnson's Codex Fundator. The Legion's goal, Fordham argued, needed to be more than have fun. The 501st should be unified and identifiable, and the best way to achieve this would be through a franchise operation. If you go to McDonald's in Chicago or Perth, you want to recognize you're in McDonald's, he says. We wanted that common identity. When you invite us to something, you don't have to ask, well, which 501st? Fordham's philosophy about the 501st is, in many ways, the opposite of Johnson's. He likes the Legion to be exact, standardized, and meritocratic. There are up to 5 Vaders in every garrison, and naturally, no event should have more than 1 Vader. Currently, the Legion offers them trooping opportunities in order of seniority. Fordham would prefer an annual audition in front of members to choose each year's Vader. If that's me, great. If not, I would want the best Vader doing an event. Fordham and his wife, Cricket, a stormtrooper, had moved from Tennessee to Utah in the late 1990s. That was a full 10-hour drive away from Lucasfilm, but Fordham frequently drove to Skywalker Ranch and back on his own dime, to show we take the brand seriously. It was on one of those visits that he was first told about Lucas and the Tournament of Roses parade. While Alban Johnson marched in blissful stormtrooper anonymity, Fordham was the Vader at the front of the pack, George Lucas's loyal enforcer. During the coverage of the parade, one celebrity announcer joked that the troopers needed to get jobs and must be marching home to their parents' basement. That kind of comment rankled. The troops were PhDs, doctors, technicians, aircraft mechanics, as well as many military and police personnel like Fordham. "We're kind of drawn to the uniform element," he says. The announcer was displaying exactly the perception of the Legion that Fordham was fighting to change with his professional charter. The conflict between Johnson's y'all-have-fun ethos and Fordham's style of strict screen accuracy and professionalism runs right through the Legion. "I've heard about intra-garrison conflicts over height restrictions," Mark says he would prefer to be a stormtrooper but is too tall. "Cricket would like to be Vader but is too short." One Asian member of the Legion wanted to portray Anakin Skywalker before his transformation into Vader. That touched off a huge internal debate about whether he should have to wear makeup to look more Caucasian. There are even disputes over the proper level of interaction with the rival good guys outfit, the Rebel Legion. "I met a couple of 501st COs who also command their local Rebel outposts. The Rebels are about a third of the size of the Imperials and seem to prefer being outnumbered." "It kind of reflects the films," says Susie Stelling, the CO of the 100-strong UK Rebel Legion base. "The Rebels are small, but we get through in the end." The ultimate irony of the 501st is that for such a fascist-looking organization, it is actually profoundly democratic. There are local and global elections to the Legion Council every February, and they're not sham elections. There's a lot of healthy, rambunctious debate in the ranks, but ultimately, they're all brothers and sisters under the Lycra. They've all literally bled for their uniforms at one time or another. The armor bite, as the plastic panel's skin-pinching is known, is felt by everyone. Everyone except the comfortably hot Vaders, that is. How do you get into the Legion? By submitting multiple photos of your costume to a compliance officer who will check the tiniest of details for screen accuracy. The 6-pouch criterion is one of many. Would-be troopers have to work hard to get their costumes up to code, although some find it easier than others. I've heard guys say they can finish their armor in a week or two, working non-stop with fast-acting glue, says Ed DeSilva, CEO of the Golden Gate Garrison in Northern California, who built his costume in 2 months. If you can handle PVC, plumbing, irrigation work, it's similar. Despite substantial economic pressure, the 501st has not succumbed to any kind of black market of armor making, nor does it encourage the purchase of even Lucasfilm-licensed Stormtrooper replica suits. Why would you want to spend $800 on eBay, DeSilva says, when you could spend $400 and be part of a club that sets standards for high quality? Some members sell pieces here and there, but we stick to a simple rule of selling costumes at cost, so there is no temptation to commercialize this, says Johnson. He describes the Legion as an eclectic and bohemian collective that trades tips and works to make good armor. There's money at stake, but it's not for them. Simply by appearing at charity events, the 501st helped raise $262,329 for all kinds of good causes in 2013, roughly double the amount raised the previous year. A charity-loving, democratic, bohemian collective of craft-minded stormtroopers? Hard as it is to believe, it works. The 501st is getting stronger all the time. They get a lot of love from Lucasfilm, which invites the local Golden Gate Garrison to early screenings of new Star Wars animated fare at the Presidio headquarters. And they reciprocate with loyalty. This rambunctious democratic group will close ranks when it comes to the creator's company. They'll not only work any Lucasfilm event for free, but appear in any Lucasfilm-endorsed commercial, such as a recent Nissan ad in Japan, which featured a red stormtrooper standing out from a pack of white ones. It's often hard to figure out who's getting the better end of the deal, Lucasfilm or the Legion. For example, at Lucasfilm's Celebration Europe 2, held in Essen, Germany in 2013, you could wander the vast show floor and find that the attractions pulling the largest crowds were provided by various branches of the 501st. The Belgian garrison provided a life-size TIE fighter they'd constructed, and it was Celebration's most popular photo spot, closely followed by a 20-foot-tall wooden AT-AT, also constructed in Belgium and signed by Lucas. May the Force not be with you, Imperial dogs, he wrote. On the one hand, Lucasfilm has at its disposal a passionate, disciplined, and creative militia, the kind of fans any company would kill for free. On the other, the Legion gets more genuine value and cachet out of making this stuff in the first place than any company could accrue. Lucasfilm would never dare offend it, and it gets to sit on the front line of fandom, exactly where it wants to be. The Legion has made itself indispensable. It has inducted a select hundred or so authors, actors, and Lucasfilm employees as honorary members. You could spot them across the celebration halls in their metallic badges with multicolored squares in the style of Imperial officers. The Legion hosted an extremely exclusive dinner with most of the stars of the original trilogy in attendance. The media couldn't get anywhere near it. The space soldiers have become the hottest ticket in the hottest franchise on Earth. It's strange, then, that one man who had an enviable role in bringing the soldiers into being in the first place all those years ago has become something of a pariah in the Star Wars community. If you want to see where the iconic plastic armor for Lucas's army of space soldiers first sprang into three-dimensional life, you have to go to Twickenham, a leafy old suburb in the far southwest of London, just down the road from Elstree, where the original Star Wars was shot. Here, across from a bucolic cricket green, in a building that was formerly a Dickensian candy shop, you will find the polar opposite of the 501st. A one-man operation producing stormtrooper armor for commercial gain, more interested in asserting his rights than he is in the subject of Star Wars, and most definitely not licensed by Lucasfilm. You will find a man who beat Lucas in court, sort of, but is losing his appeal in the court of fandom. You will begin to unravel the curious case of Andrew Ainsworth. Ainsworth is a wiry, friendly fellow with a neatly trimmed black and white beard and a twinkle in his eye. He's an industrial designer, skilled in vacuum forming, and he gets especially animated discussing the quality of reflected light that makes these uniforms look like much more than plastic. At such moments, Ainsworth looks quite a bit younger than his 64 years. When I met Ainsworth at his shop, we sat for hours drinking cups of tea amid stormtrooper replicas. Ainsworth brought out to me what he claimed was one of the first stormtrooper helmets ever made. He told the story behind the helmet, how his friend, artist Nick Pemberton, got him involved in the production of Star Wars in January 1976. Pemberton told Ainsworth to buy him a pint if anything came of it. "I had no idea what it was," he says. "I thought it was a puppet show. Nick used to work on those for television." Pemberton brought Ainsworth a maquette of the Stormtrooper helmet that was based on Lucasfilm concept sketches and paintings. Ainsworth had an oversized vacuum-forming machine he used to make plastic canoes and fish ponds. Pemberton asked Ainsworth if he could make the helmet prototype. He made one in 2 days. He took that into Lucas, and Lucas said, "That's great. I'll have 50 more," says Ainsworth. The production was rushing to get sets and costumes to Tunisia at the time. Ainsworth remembers a line of white limos idling outside the shop, each one waiting for the next helmet. "The studio was so keen to get them, as soon as we finished one, they'd drive away with it," he chuckles. As he told the story, Ainsworth fiddled with the rim of the supposedly historic helmet, causing a little tear in the side. He didn't even blink. The Star Wars fan, the historian, the preservationist in me all want to scream at him, "No, stop! Put that thing under glass!" This was my first inkling that Ainsworth, despite his boasting of a place in the franchise's history, and it is, alas, a rather expandable thing, this boasting of his, failed to get the idea of Star Wars. Ainsworth and his partner, Bernadette, have been together since the 1960s, when he used to make cars in shipping crates outside her South London flat. Then they bought this former candy shop and founded Shepperton Design Studios. No one disputes that SDS produced stormtrooper helmets and armor, TIE fighter pilot helmets, rebel pilot helmets, and rebel troop helmets, all from outside the UK studio system, which was rigidly controlled by unions at the time. Ainsworth's uncredited role made him £30,000, more than most of the names that showed up on screen at the end of Star Wars. And that was the last of his involvement with the franchise. Ainsworth showed remarkably little interest in the Star Wars phenomenon as it exploded around the world, and only caught the original movie once on TV years later. In the late 1990s, looking to pay school fees for his kids, he dug up the old forming tools, made another batch of helmets, and tried selling them at a local market. He found few buyers, and they ended up on the top of the bedroom wardrobe. In 2002, Bernadette declared she was going to sell them online. Ainsworth says he didn't think they'd get a penny. As it turned out, when they were listed on Christie's as original helmets, they got $4,000 each. Shepperton Design Studios launched its website and went into the Stormtrooper helmet business in 2003. After selling 19 helmets to customers in the United States for £35 apiece, Ainsworth got a call from Howard Rothman, head of Lucas Licensing. Ainsworth recounts the call. "Who are you?" Rothman demanded. "I'm the guy who made these Stormtrooper helmets." "No, you're not. We did." Lucasfilm Legal does not mess around. The company promptly sued and won a $20 million punitive judgment against Ainsworth in a U.S. court. A U.K. bailiff brought Ainsworth the demand some weeks later. Ever affable, Ainsworth made the bailiff a cup of tea. After 4 years of fighting Lucasfilm in the U.K. High Court of Justice, Court of Appeal, and finally Supreme Court, Ainsworth won something of a split decision. The Supreme Court ruled that the U.S. judgment was enforceable in the United Kingdom. Ainsworth was still on the hook for $4 million, all for selling 19 Stormtrooper helmets in the United States. After Disney bought Lucasfilm, the company settled with Ainsworth for a mere £90,000. Ainsworth was still stuck with legal fees around £1 million. But the court also ruled that Stormtrooper costumes were props, not sculpture, as Lucasfilm had insisted. It was an important distinction. The copyright on sculpture lasts for 75 years in the United Kingdom. The copyright on props runs out after 15. So while Ainsworth had an enormous legal bill, he was also free to keep selling stormtrooper helmets and armor. And sell them he does, for hundreds of pounds apiece, along with original Dark Lord costumes and original R2 droids. So original, apparently, he dare not fully name the characters. One of Ainsworth's legal tactics was to countersue Lucas on the grounds that he had designed the stormtrooper costume himself, and Lucas was breaching his copyright. This patently ridiculous claim was thrown out of court, but that hasn't stopped Ainsworth repeating it ever since. In 2013, Ainsworth participated in a London art show at the Saatchi Gallery, in which various artists were given stormtrooper helmets as canvases. He was described on the gallery literature as the creator of the stormtrooper. I wasn't surprised to read that the High Court judge had described him as viewing events through his own Ainsworth-tinted spectacles. Ainsworth made something of a splash in Star Wars forums around the time of his court case, but fans soon suspected they were dealing with someone who didn't seem to know very much about the franchise and was willing to make up his own details. For example, his explanation in one interview for why he didn't work on The Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi is that Lucas didn't return to the United Kingdom after his experience with the unions, which is untrue. He claims that his armor was reused on the subsequent movies and that it looked pretty ratty by the end. In fact, the armor was recast for Return of the Jedi. It's not surprising that he didn't know that, because he told me he had only watched Star Wars once on television, and neither of the other movies of the classic trilogy. It's a shame, because Ainsworth did play a small but vital role in the making of the original film, and somewhere under his miasma of self-justification and faulty memory is a small business success story. The judge gives him credit for the design of the X-Wing pilot's helmet, for instance, because the Marine helmet he was supposed to be basing the design on never arrived from the United States. At nearly 40 years' distance, however, it is doubtful whether this particular tale will ever be objectively told. Adding to the confusion is the testimony of Brian Muir, a sculptor who worked at Elstree and sculpted the maquette, or scale model, for Vader's helmet, which was made in-house out of heavier fiberglass. In court, Muir claimed that the stormtrooper helmet was sculpted not by Ainsworth's friend Nick Pemberton, but by another sculptor, Liz Moore, who also sculpted the prototype 3PO costume. Moore died tragically young some years later. In court, Muir's claim was quickly thrown into question. Moore's boyfriend at the time testified that she sculpted in a different kind of clay than the one seen in the only photo of the stormtrooper sculpture that exists. The judge found that Pemberton, not Moore, sculpted the stormtrooper helmet, which makes sense. How else would Ainsworth have become involved in the first place, except through his friend Pemberton? But that didn't stop Muir from taking to the internet, including 500 First forums, with vehement attacks on Ainsworth and a spirited defense of Liz Moore's memory. Digging deeper into Muir's story, however, it becomes clear that he isn't actually claiming to have first-hand knowledge of Moore's sculpture, just that other unnamed people in the crew told him she had produced it. Muir told me in a testy email explaining why he didn't want to be interviewed that it actually doesn't matter who sculpted the helmet, so long as it wasn't Ainsworth. In 2011, after the Supreme Court gave Ainsworth the go-ahead to continue selling stormtrooper helmets and armor, another UK company called RS Propmasters happened to start selling its own screen-accurate stormtrooper suits, recast from a set of armor from the original movie that had been found in an attic. Muir added his endorsement. His daughter started a Facebook page devoted to ridiculing the quality of Ainsworth's stormtrooper reproductions. The feud between Muir and Ainsworth, it seems, has moved into the marketplace. The contrast between these tangled tales and the more laudable efforts of Alban Johnson and Mark Fordham is dramatic, but also instructive. When Star Wars fans work for free, fired up by a love of the franchise, you get the 501st. But when there's business at stake, a chance to make some money from the phenomenon, you get unseemly feuds like Ainsworth's and Muir's. It's the kind of unintended consequence that the creator, sketching space soldiers in art class, could never have foreseen. 4. Hyperspace Drive, Space soldiers, in their Tommy Tomorrow and Flash Gordon guises, were far from the only obsession in the young Lucas's life. Soon enough, they weren't even the central one. In his teens, Lucas's attention shifted from drawing and comics to cameras and cars. An auto accident, the most important turning point in Lucas's entire creative history, led him to rethink his approach to school. He discovered the study of humanity and became fascinated by photography. Only then, belatedly, did he fall into film, take the key classes and meet the key people who would set him off down the path to the stars. None of these other obsessions ever left Lucas entirely, however. They all informed his most well-known work. So as tempting as it is to detour around Lucas's turns as a boy racer, greasy mechanic, reformed anthropology student, and artsy film school prodigy, this scenic route actually has much to tell us about the Star Wars story. Quite simply, that story would not have developed in the way it did without these 12 key stops along the road. 1. Car culture. Every Lucas movie features a fast-paced chase or race in some kind of hot rod or pod. The Star Wars films felt faster at the time of their release than anything else on screen, and their speed didn't just come from Lucas's years of obsessive TV watching. Rather, it came from that sense of flow and motion, excitement and danger one can only get from behind the wheel of a speeding vehicle. In Star Wars, Lucas would say that he wanted spaceships that people got into and drove around like cars. This was his version of a magic carpet to Mars. When Lucas was 16, his ever-benevolent father bought him his first car, a tiny Italian super-mini called a Bianchina. George Sr. probably figured the kid couldn't do much damage with this 479cc Fiat-made motor and top speed of 60 miles per hour. Lucas called it a dumb little car with a sewing machine engine. But Lucas had a knack for making a little go a long way. He spent his spare hours and his allowance at the Foreign Car Service, a garage for hot rodders with a go-kart track out back. He made some special modifications himself, adding a straight pipe and a roll bar and a seatbelt from an Air Force jet, and learned how to hug the curves at top speed. It didn't look like much, but it had it where it counts. The first time he flipped the car, he tore the roof out rather than repair it. You can almost feel the horror creeping up the spine of George Sr., who still entertained hopes that his son might take over the Lucas Company business someday. Lucas Jr. acquired a fake ID that said he was over 21. This let him enter autocross contests in parking lots and fairgrounds, winning more than his share of trophies. He became good friends with Modesto's autocross champion, Alan Grant, who would assume briefly the role of an elder brother figure for the young racer. Grant described a kid who was quiet until he got to know you, and then wouldn't stop babbling. Who knows what space soldier-filled ramblings got cut short when Grant told Lucas, as he frequently did, to shut up. He was always jabbering about a story, and what about this, and doing this, and you know, says Grant. We didn't take him too serious. When George Jr. was a teenager, the upwardly mobile Lucas family moved to a walnut ranch on the edge of town. Until he got his car, he was a quiet loner who kept to his bedroom outside of meal times and TV time, ate Hershey bars, drank Cokes, read comics, played rock and roll and jazz 45s, and shot the occasional BB pellet out of the window. But cruising culture put him in the swing of Modesto's social scene. 10th and 11th streets on Friday nights were a fascinating parade of chrome. There were ritual courtesies. Kids left their cars unlocked so friends could sit in them. If you had a favorite parking spot, other kids would hold it for you. Lucas slid into a phase of minor juvenile delinquency, filling a glove compartment with speeding tickets and appearing in court after he'd racked up too many. He didn't join the real-life gang depicted in American Graffiti, the Pharaohs, but he did become their enabler. His job, the story goes, was to lure local toughs into fights by sitting his scrawny self next to them in the local burger joint. When the inevitable challenge came, he would run away, leading his quarry to the Pharaohs. It's a telling image. George Lucas, young, beardless, with a bowl haircut, 5'6" in flannel shirt and blue jeans, blackened by engine grease, waltzing straight into danger, facing it like a Zen master, secure in the knowledge that he had backup. He never had to put up his fists. 2. The crash. The cracks in the facade of young Lucas's grease-soaked life appeared at school. For years, his grades had hovered around C's and D's. He was only saved from F's by his younger sister Wendy's homework help. He knew he was going to be a race car driver or a mechanic, so who cared about grades? Answer, George Sr. and Dorothy Lucas, who had been model students, class president and vice president in their day. They tried to encourage his visual sensibilities, buying him a Nikon camera and constructing a darkroom. Lucas took the camera to the racetrack. But Lucas's alleyway friend, John Plummer, was going to the University of Southern California for business school, and George Jr. wondered whether college was right for him, too. Never above nudging his son with elaborate gifts, George Sr. agreed to send the kid on a backpacking trip to Europe with Plummer if Lucas graduated high school. That became the goal of the summer of 1962. Lucas hit the books in the local library. It was a grind. His heart wasn't in it. Bored, he returned early one hot afternoon, making an illegal left turn on the road to the Lucas family ranch. At the same moment, a Chevy, driven by a Downey High classmate, one Lucas probably couldn't see in the rear view for his own dust, had run a red light and was trying to overtake him on the left. The force of the impact flung Lucas through the roof he had made. He only survived because his Air Force seatbelt snapped. A proper belt would have locked him in the car as it wrapped around a walnut tree. Lucas's lungs hemorrhaged, but he was extraordinarily lucky. He was out of Modesto's Kindred Hospital within 2 weeks, albeit with months of physical therapy ahead of him. The crash had destroyed the Bianchina, wrecked his chances of backpacking around Europe, and garnered one more traffic ticket from the cops for that illegal left turn. But it also gave him a pass. Downey High graduated him without looking at his grades. Still, a profound lesson had been learned. "He became quieter and more intense," remembered Mel Cellini. The Foreign Car Service tried to cheer him up by bringing him a racing helmet with a roller skate taped on top. Lucas's head was somewhere else. The crash changed everything. That is about the only constant when Lucas has told the story of his life over the years. It made him more mindful and more fearless. "It gave me this perspective on life that said I'm operating on extra credit," Lucas told Oprah Winfrey in 2012. "I'm never afraid of dying. What I'm getting is bonus material." If Lucas had died in the crash, what kind of It's a Wonderful Life alternate universe would we be in? Not just one without Star Wars and its imitators, but also without much of a special effects industry. If we had summer blockbusters at all, they would be more disaster movies in the style of Jaws and less science fiction or fantasy spectaculars. There would probably be no Star Trek on the big screen and certainly no Battlestar Galactica on the small one. It's distinctly possible that 20th Century Fox would have gone bankrupt after 1977. Certainly the pattern of investor takeover would have been different, and Rupert Murdoch might not control it today. We'd have fewer cineplexes and fewer screens for movies overall. We also wouldn't have The Godfather in its Coppola-directed incarnation, nor Apocalypse Now. What's most interesting to consider, however, is whether this Star Wars-less universe would still have come to pass if George Lucas hadn't made that illegal left turn in the first place, failed to graduate, and gone off in search of glory on the Grand Prix circuit like he'd wanted his whole teenage life. Some stories, it seems, require a blood sacrifice. 3. 2187. Several months after the accident, Lucas enrolled in Modesto Junior College for the next 2 years, earning an A in anthropology and a B in sociology. For the first time, he was getting an education he craved, one that engaged him, one he was even able to apply to the rituals of the cruising scene around him. He went through that 20th century rite of passage for smart adolescents, reading Brave New World and 1984. Both renditions of dystopian futures left their usual indelible mark, especially at a time when the world seemed inches from the brink of suicide, as it did during the Cuban Missile Crisis that October 1962. But where were the uplifting positive stories to counterbalance and help make sense of frightening times? There was, Lucas says, he realized at this point, no longer a lot of mythology in our society. More important than his graduation certificate to Lucas and the Star Wars saga was a growing interest in art house or personal films, kindled on weekend jaunts to Berkeley in San Francisco with Plummer. It was his first taste of the North Beach coffee house scene, where independent artists in black turtlenecks would hang bedsheets from ceilings and project their latest dream. By far the most influential short Lucas ever saw was 2187. The film's vital statistics make it sound light years away from Star Wars, and yet there's a key connection. Lasting less than 10 minutes, 2187 was made in 1963 by a troubled young filmmaker in Montreal, Arthur Lipsett, who used random audio and discarded footage from the National Film Board of Canada. What Lipsett came up with, however, was the definition of transcendent. The images in 2187 are mostly of people, up close and personal, looking at the camera, caught in candid moments. Men feed pigeons and stare up at their city, pensive in an everyday sort of way. There are no secrets, just the plain facts of life, says one man off screen. Why can't we bring these things out into the open? Over the faces of old people, a lady declares, I don't believe in mortality. I believe in immortality. The film itself opens with the title over a picture of a skull. It's a memento mori as well as a memento machina. The title comes from a discussion about the mechanization of society and how it fulfills our need to fit in. Somebody walks up and says, Your number's 2187, says the voiceover. Boy, does that person really smile? This notion would find its reflection in Star Wars. Think of how many beings in it, from droids to stormtroopers, are identified by their number. But it was not 2187's greatest contribution to the future movie. About 3 minutes in, as birds fly over a cityscape and old men watch and feed them, we hear this. Many people feel that in the contemplation of nature and in communication with other living things, they become aware of some kind of force or something behind this apparent mask which we see in front of us, and they call it God. Some kind of force or something. In later years, Lucas would point out that religious writers had been using the phrase life force for thousands of years, but he also acknowledged a debt to 2187 and stated that the force in Star Wars was an echo of Lipsett's film. At film school, he would load 2187 onto the projector more than 20 times. Haskell Wexler. In 1963, while Lucas was still a student at Modesto Junior College, his parents bought him his first 8mm film camera, just like the one he played with back in the alleyway. He took it to speedways around the state, as he had with the Nikon they had given him in high school. While filming at these racetracks, Lucas worked as a mechanic in the pit with a racing group known as the AWOL Sports Car Competition Club. Lucas also edited the AWOL newsletter known as BS. Seriously. If he wasn't meant to race cars, he could at least tinker with them. That was how one weekend afternoon at Laguna Seca, Lucas got chatting with a customer who noticed his camera. Haskell Wexler, famed cinematographer. Immediately, Wexler could tell the kid had a certain eye, a certain hunger for the visual. Lucas's friendship with Wexler would pull his life powerfully in a new direction. Wexler showed the student around his commercial film house. It was the first time Lucas saw the movie industry in the wild and became aware that movie careers existed. Wexler said he would have gotten Lucas a production assistant job, possibly on a documentary Wexler was working on, The Bus, but that it was nixed by film unions. Lucas said that was the point he turned his back on Hollywood. In fact, Wexler would keep trying to get Lucas a job within the Hollywood system for the rest of the youngster's time in school with little success. Around the time he met Wexler, Lucas was figuring out his next move beyond junior college. The first to accept him was San Francisco State, where he would have pursued a degree in anthropology. He also applied to do illustration and photography at the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena. His father torpedoed that dream by telling his son he'd have to pay for it himself. Lucas says he was too lazy to even consider that. Meanwhile, John Plummer was thoroughly enjoying his time at USC and thought Lucas might get a kick out of the film school's photography program. "It's supposed to be easier than PE," Plummer told Lucas. That was all the kid needed to hear. Wexler called up a USC instructor called Mel Sloan. Legend has it, his words were, "For God's sake, watch this kid." This may have tipped the scales, or Lucas's newfound aptitude may have shown through on the test. It mattered not. USC accepted Lucas, and the young man continued to be pulled inexorably toward film. His father came up with a generous solution. He would pay George Jr.'s way through school as an employee of his company. Lucas would get $200 a month. Lucas Sr. may have reasoned that film school would confer a valuable lesson. After all, nobody graduated from film school and immediately found work at a studio. They were first taken on as apprentices. If you made it to the dizzying heights of assistant editor after 4 years of apprenticeship, you would have to wait another 4 years until you could edit film. Hollywood was a closed fortress of nepotism, yet there was always a place where nepotism would work in Lucas's favor. Modesto. "You'll be back in a few years," George Sr. told his son. "No, I won't. I'm going to be a millionaire before I'm 30," Lucas shot back. Or at least, so he remembered as a millionaire in his 30s. 5. USC. When did Star Wars first emerge as a cinematic concept? Where did the love of Flash Gordon transmogrify into the idea of putting some version of it on celluloid? Lucas's answer is frustratingly imprecise. Sometime during film school. "You end up with a little stack of ideas for great movies you'd love to make," he told Starlog magazine in 1981. "I had this idea for doing a space adventure. It was such an obvious thing that I was amazed no one had ever done it before." No student was less likely to have emerged as the star of the class. Lucas began at USC as a junior, and he was a photography major, not a cinema major. He began with only two classes at the film school. Film was not the cool subject it is today, and the department was banished to a Spartan building called the Stables on the edge of campus. In his opening address, the dean of the school told students there was still time to get their tuition back. Conditions were crowded, equipment limited, and scheduling editorial and mixing equipment was challenging, remembers Lucas's classmate Howard Kazanjian. "We learned to work together. We created the feeling of family. The facility was old and funky, but I would have had it no other way." Lucas was increasingly drawn to the geeks and the nerds of his film classes, despite their pariah status. "No one wanted to be around us," he remembered in 2013. "We were bearded and strange." He compared his compatriots to modern-day Googlers and Facebookers. Something exciting and new was going on within the Stables, and the kids sensed it. Lucas shunned the screenwriting class, run by the infamous Irwin Blacker, from which students had been known to emerge in tears. He didn't care for plot or dialogue. Sound and vision were all he wanted to learn about. He took a history of film class with Arthur Knight, whose enthusiasm was infectious. Knight screened Metropolis, the 1927 masterpiece by Fritz Lang. It imagined a future city where an imperious master is challenged by rebel workers. The master's son ventures into the underworld in pursuit of the female leader of the rebellion, and the master orders a machine made in her image in order to discredit her. Lucas would file that iconic golden robot away in his mind, where it would stay for years, becoming fluent in over 6 million forms of communication. 6. Clean-cut cinema. Don Glut arrived at USC the same year as Lucas. He, like George, started as a junior. The two met when Lucas and his dorm roommate, Chris Lewis, along with Glute's roommate, Randall Kleiser, founded the Clean Cut Cinema Club, where members took turns screening movies. Glute joined too, though he didn't quite fit in with the club's deliberately uncool ethos. "I was the only one in the club with long hair," says Glute. After the Beatles came out, everyone grew their hair long. That's what girls wanted, so that's what we did. But Lucas and Kleiser and Lewis were groomed perfectly. Lucas wouldn't gain the lead until he returned to USC as a graduate student. Indeed, the CCCC had a reactionary bent aimed at the beatnik guys dominating the cinema department, the ones exhorting them to follow Jean-Luc Godard into independent filmmaking and telling them they couldn't get a job in the industry. Lucas and his cohorts had a different concept of what that industry could be. The CCCC tended to shy away from screening the then-fashionable works of New Wave French cinema. That's what the professors were into, so the CCCC wanted to be into something else. Glute was a brash, blue-collar Chicagoan who loved comic books and superheroes. A friend at Republic Pictures got him reels of old serial episodes, which is what he screened for the club. Captain Marvel, Rocket Man, Spy Smashers, Zorro. Despite his love for Flash Gordon serials, Lucas was seeing most of these other serials for the first time, Glute recalls. It should be noted that Glute has an axe to grind against Lucas, who failed to help Glute out of his dire financial straits with further work after he wrote the Empire Strikes Back novelization. He let me interview him with the understanding that he would not be made to appear to say anything positive about Lucasfilm. In his second year, Lucas rented an $80 a month place up in Benedict Canyon, the name of which may well have inspired Tatooine's Beggar's Canyon. Kleiser moved in, and the pair threw a party at which Glute screened an episode of The Adventures of Captain Marvel. Glute loved this stuff, but he also recognized the dumber scenes when he saw them. In one, Captain Marvel is following a car whose driver has been knocked unconscious. The car careens down a winding road, somehow managing to avoid going off the edge. "That's impossible," laughed Glute. Lucas looked at him very seriously. "No," he insisted. "The car would follow the contours of the road." The two shared a love of cheesy serials, but Glute's passion for them got him into trouble. Each classroom had a 16mm projector. You could screen anything if there wasn't a class in session. Glute was screening his serials for an audience one night when he was ejected by Herb Kosower, the animation teacher. In 1965, Glute had to take his camera class over again after turning in a movie called Superman vs. the Gorilla Gang for his final assignment. It fulfilled the requirements, but the teacher failed him. Why? Because it's a Superman movie. Lucas, by contrast, kept his own love for such things out of school bounds, although it ate up his extracurricular life. Kleiser remembered trying to urge him out of his room and to go to parties, but Lucas just wanted to stay in and draw Star Troopers, Kleiser said. All those years after art class, he was still picturing space soldiers. 7. Look at life. As a junior, Lucas took Kosower's animation class. While Glute hated Kosower, Lucas sat in the front row, intent on learning how everything worked, ready to overachieve. Almost immediately, he discovered he had a talent for animation, and how. In 1965, George Lucas made his first short movie, born of an early homework assignment that couldn't have been more basic. The students had been instructed to take a minute of 16mm film, run it through the Oxbury camera, and make something move. What Lucas did with that minute was extraordinary and still holds up today as if it were a great YouTube short, which it now effectively is. It's called Look at Life. The title referred to the two popular weekly photo magazines, Look and Life. Lucas cut out his favorite pictures and strung them together in a collage in the style of Lipset's 2187. As in all subsequent Lucas films, the music was in the driving seat. In this case, the first track from the soundtrack to the Brazilian film Black Orpheus, which happens to be a minute long. It opens with a lilting guitar over which Lucas zooms out from an eye, a face behind wire mesh. Then an urgent samba bursts in, appearing as rudely as would years later the first chord of John Williams's Star Wars theme. We see snarling dogs in Alabama, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Klansmen,